A History of Ancient Sparta, Lecture 5, Spartan Art and Culture.
Spartan art and culture, based at least on traditional accounts of what Sparta was like, might seem to be a sort of contradiction in terms. And it is true from 550 or so, more or less, that Sparta really did seem to de-emphasize some aspects of what we ordinarily think of as culture and as art. This wasn't so much deliberately to stupefy themselves or to make themselves into a dull and one-dimensional culture, nor was it entirely a kind of simplification of communal life to secure greater military readiness and focus. In a sense, it was something more like a redirection of energy away from artifacts towards people. The art form of Sparta, the distinctive art form of Sparta, was not so much, in Spartan eyes, beautiful architecture, beautiful statues, beautiful pottery, and so forth, as admirable character and beautiful bodies. So it's a strange kind of thing. You get a sense of this in a statement, a quip, attributed to Gorgo, who was the daughter of one Spartan king and the wife of Leonidas, who purportedly, when asked by a woman from Attica, "Why are you Spartan women the only ones who can rule men?" purportedly replied, "Because we're the only ones who give birth to men." The idea being that Sparta uniquely produced and was designed to produce what at least the Spartans considered to be ideal human specimens rather than ideal artifacts. So too, even in speech. That's part of the logic behind the laconic quips, the taciturn, tight, to-the-point quips for which the Spartans were famous. Their whole aesthetic was minimized in a certain sense, based on a kind of minimal dissipation of effort, high-impact statement saying as much as possible in as few words as possible. Molon labe, come and take them, is an example there. But again, as I suggested before, the messes evidently, and Spartan daily life evidently, again, at least among Spartans, presumably the Helots felt differently, was characterized by a kind of pervasive humor and cheerfulness, which I personally don't find all that hard to believe. It's not to say, though, that there was no Spartan literature at all. We don't have very much that remains. You can read the complete surviving works of the Spartans within less than 50 pages, but there was some. A poet by the name of Kynathon, evidently in the 6th century, another, purportedly the best of them, man by the name of Alcmon, about 600, and the official poet of Sparta, whose works were memorized and were thought to be particularly good for getting people psyched up for battle, Tyrtaeus, who flourished about 650. For a good long while, too, Sparta, at least on occasion, welcomed other poets from elsewhere. Terpander of Lesbos was the first victor at the Carnea, supposedly, in 676. Stesichorus of Sicily came to Sparta in the 550s. He is famous, among other things, for claiming that Helen, in fact, never went to Troy and that she spent the war in Egypt while the Greeks were fighting over a phantom Helen. And the epitaphs of Simonides, which we'll have occasion to quote later on, and the epigrams of Simonides were welcomed at Sparta as well. Nevertheless, you have to admit, certainly in comparison with Athens or even with Boeotia, that's a pretty slender hall. No one, of course, comes close to matching Athens, but even still, Sparta's literary remains are relatively insignificant and relatively slight, and to some extent, there's no way around it. That really and truly was by design. The remains of visual art of one sort or another are more impressive. There are quite a few figurines surviving, made largely of bronze, many of them coming from the shrine at Artemis Orthia. Lots of them are figurines of horses. Horses were a high status item in the Greek world. Land, which is good for raising horses, is extremely hard to come by in Greece, and only the wealthiest people could afford to have horses, which is one reason why, contrary to what we might expect, far and away the highest prestige event in the ancient Olympic Games was the four-horse chariot race. Being able to support four horses was a tremendous statement of status in and of itself, and that was immense prestige to win in that event. All of the names, Philip and so forth, any name that contains the element H-I-P-P, hip, is horse-centered in Greece. Hippos is the word for horse, and they were infatuated with them, as only people who wanted lots and couldn't have them are likely to be infatuated. They also, unsurprisingly, especially between 550 and 525, dedicated a lot of figurines of warriors, which are valuable in several senses. They're nice figurines in and of themselves. The workmanship quality is high. I mean, it's not like the works of Phidias, but they're nice. They're well done. They also show us what Spartan warriors actually looked like, enshrouded in their cloaks, barefoot, maybe wearing sandals, but apparently barefoot in most instances. As I said before, in some cases, not wearing pants, which is not the way I would want to fight, but there you have it. And very famously and very revealingly, discovered originally in Albania, which suggests that there was something of a foreign market for Spartan wear early on, is a famous figurine of a girl who is either dancing or running. She looks to be an adolescent girl, as we'll see in just a moment. Adolescent girls in Sparta did exercise publicly. The rest of the Greeks called them thigh flashers because of their revealing garments or lack of garments. She's wearing basically a knee-length shift. She is pulling up the shift to facilitate her movement in running, at least with one hand. The shift goes over one shoulder and then goes beneath her right breast, and she looks very energetic, very cheerful, and very much unlike any other female figure that I am aware of coming from Greece. They also, the Spartans, had at least some sculptural tradition. I already spoke of the statue, which is termed Leonidas, though by general consensus is not Leonidas, which forms the central exhibit in the Spartan Museum at Sparta, and which is, again, in my view in any case, a very fine and moving piece of work. They also, surprisingly enough, at least early on, before 550, produced some very high-quality ivory work, which is not what you would expect. This involves also more foreign trade than you would be inclined to attribute to Sparta as traditionally conceived. Elephants being in Laconia then and now relatively thin on the ground. I mentioned in the last lecture the strange masks reminiscent of Iroquois false faces, which turn up at the temple of Artemis Orthia. And the Spartans also produced pottery for export. The high point then was between 650 to 625. They kept on producing export pottery to some extent up till about 520, when that industry or that craft seems to have withered, and what pottery they used was by and large made elsewhere. Likewise, Spartan architecture, based on the admittedly sketchy surviving remains, some of which admittedly come from Rome, was not quite as minimal as references both in times contemporary to classical Sparta and more recently would lead you to expect. There is, in fact, not a great deal, but something to see if you go to the Spartan Acropolis, and there is also something to see at Artemis Orthia as well, although that may well be later. Nevertheless, by classical times, certainly the only form of conspicuous consumption which seems to have been going on in any major way at Sparta among the wealthier Spartan citizens was chariot racing, at which they did extremely well with many Olympic victories, and whatever excess energies they had in a financial sense seemed to have been largely devoted there. Well, there was one other set of arts, though, at which, by the unanimous testimony of antiquity, the Spartans excelled. Were not just okay compared with other folks, were the equal of any and perhaps the superior. And that was at an art which was important throughout Greece, but for reasons that we've alluded to already, particularly important at Sparta, and that is choral dance and song. It's very, very difficult for us to know or to imagine what that was like, but we know that the contemporary witnesses who were impressed were also, in some instances, people who would have seen the dithyrambs at Athens and Athenian festivals and Athenian tragedy, and they were impressed by it, which suggests that at its best, whatever was going on, however irrecoverable it may be, it was top quality and very impressive, as indeed the choral dance of people who had been practicing since childhood with not just state subsidy, but in effect state coercion, one would expect them to be spectacular at it. And by all accounts, so they were. The choral dancing in Sparta and the choral song in Sparta, by the way, involved men, but also involved women. And before we change our focus and look more narrowly at Spartan history, we should take a moment to talk about the unique position of women in Sparta, which struck other Greeks and indeed non-Hellenes very strongly as long as Sparta remained a powerful, independent culture. Spartan women were reputedly beautiful. The most beautiful women in Greece, Helen herself, was a Spartan. No accident. They did not use makeup, but nevertheless, because of their exercise and also, perhaps, horrible to say, but because of the severe selection practices with regard to who got to survive in Sparta, they were evidently, hands down, the prettiest women around. The Spartan men, by the way, were bigger, stronger, and better looking than other men as well. So the nearly unanimous testimony of antiquity would suggest they could be rich and rich in their own right. They were independent-minded. Compared with other Greek women, they were very talkative and they were in many cases provably powerful. Very, very different from the situation elsewhere in Greece. This is one of the places where, on the basis of nothing but my own very possibly flawed intuition, I wonder if there was not some enduring influence of Crete. As I've suggested earlier on, the Spartans themselves were under the impression that many of their institutions had Cretan parallels, if not Cretan antecedents, and the position of women in Crete, if the existing archaeological remains are anything resembling an accurate representation of what was going on, the position of women in Crete was high, and it was high in Sparta as well. Again, it's no accident that they have a shrine to Helen of Troy, who was, whatever else she may have been, legendarily beautiful, and her actions would suggest more than usually independent-minded. Aristotle, in his Politics, in fact, thought that one of Sparta's major problems was the degree to which women in Sparta ran things. And in several respects, that really was unique. For one thing, Spartan women alone of women in Greece could inherit property in their own right, which is to say, Spartan women could own land, and owning land has been a route to power in pretty much every culture where that was possible. Elsewhere in Greece, women were ordinarily expected to be silent and to be at home, and when they were in public, to be dressed in something not unlike contemporary Islamic guise. They were not supposed to have any public impact whatsoever, certainly not in Athens and not elsewhere. The only exceptions were prostitutes. Spartan women, by contrast, did leave public lives, and from the perspective of everybody else in Greece, they had a unique and scandalous freedom and power. It reminds me a bit, when I read what other Greeks thought of Spartan women, it's a bit like what I have heard Europeans say about American women. They are beautiful, they are unusually free, they do exactly what they want, and dare I say it, I have heard Europeans say this, and I don't want to give offense, but I have heard Europeans claim that American women are free with their sexual favors. Whether that was only the people I was talking with who believed that, I don't know, but I have heard Europeans say that. Certainly people said that about women in Sparta, and in some respects with regard to women in Sparta, not without reason. For one thing, they had a form of the agoge of their own. They did not live together in barracks like boys did, but they did exercise communally together, as I said before, often nude, not always, sometime. Nobody really entirely believes this, but there are records that suggest that not only did they wrestle nude, they sometimes wrestled boys nude. I don't know if that's true or not, but there is testimony that that is, in fact, what was going on. And there is no doubt that they were encouraged to use their sexual attractiveness as a lure to encourage boys into greater efforts of one sort or another. Spartan women were in many cases literate. Upper-level Spartan women generally literate, and again were freer than women anywhere else. Something that's odd about that, and this is something that seems to me counterintuitive, but I've noticed this just in reading, that the women in at least some warrior cultures, cultures which are very strongly keyed on battle, and there's reasons why this would make a certain amount of sense, have often had women who, by the standards of those around them who were less warlike, seemed unusually prominent and powerful. The Romans were scandalized by the power of the women of pre-modern Germany in the Germanic tribes. Norse women, the women of the Viking culture, were very powerful and certainly had a mind of their own and a public role which was far more extensive than those of women in the Mediterranean basin, by and large. The Iroquois were in some respects a matrilinear society. The idea, I suppose, to the extent that it makes sense at all, where the men are away fighting a lot of the time, somebody has to be running things, and that somebody in that case has to be independent, powerful women. Be that as it may, that certainly was the case in Sparta. Their marriage customs were interesting as well. Marriage was odd. It was that they pleaded a sort of marriage by capture. When women were married, it was contrary to our expectations, they would ordinarily cut their hair short and keep it short. And at that point, the men would be growing their hair longer and longer and longer. They also sanctioned, in some circumstances, a kind of tolerated adultery. An older man with a younger wife, according to reports, was certainly allowed and perhaps encouraged to invite a young friend whom he admired, especially if he already had children of his own, to sleep with his wife and have some good, strong children that way, now that he was sort of, you know, on the far side of the down curve. Women, we're told, really liked that arrangement because they got to run two houses instead of one. And running a house for a Spartan woman, a Spartan citizen woman, was different than running a house elsewhere in Greece, since the helots did all of the housework. She did no housework at all. A Spartan woman's sole goal, which was highly valorized by the state, was what the Spartans called technopoia, bearing children. And indeed, that was so important to the Spartans that, kings aside, the only Spartans who had their names put on their graves fell into one of two classes. Men who died in war, and it would ordinarily say, Anaxandridas died in war. Or, on the notion that this was equivalent to war, whatever woman it was who died in childbirth. So there is a kind of equation there suggested between defending the state and producing the men who will defend the state, the people who will defend the state, both being potentially life-threatening actions. And indeed, looking at the number of Spartan males who lived to a ripe old age, and considering the fact that absent modern medical interventions, about 10% of pregnancies result in the death of the mother, the odds were pretty similar. Though better for the Spartans because, again, the agoge and their physical fitness was designed to make childbearing as easy for them as it could possibly be. Also unique, I mentioned one just a bit ago, are the collections of women's sayings which have come to us from Sparta. Women, remember, elsewhere in Greek culture were basically supposed to keep silent. Not so in Sparta. I mentioned one issuing from Gorgo, the daughter of King Cleomenes, who then later married her uncle, Leonidas. She, as a child of 8 or 9, when Aristagoras of Miletus was trying to persuade her father, king of Sparta, to intervene on his behalf against Persia, and when persuasion didn't work, resorted to bribery, offering him successively larger and larger bribes, Gorgo supposedly said, "Daddy, this nasty foreigner is going to corrupt you if you don't send him out of here." And her dad did send him out of here. She also, on another occasion, when a message came to Sparta from Persia, which had no message, was purportedly the only person in Sparta who figured out how to read it. The message came on a wax tablet, which was empty, and Gorgo, so we are told, suggested scrape off the wax. And when they scraped off the wax, by George, there was the message. Another famous Spartan woman is Kineska, who has the wonderful name, it means puppy. It literally means bitch puppy, girl puppy, who was the sister of Agesilaus II, king of Sparta, and was the first, and to the best of my knowledge, the only woman in antiquity to win an Olympic title. Women were not even allowed to watch the Olympic Games, but in Sparta, remember, women could own property. And Kineska owned racehorses and was victorious in the chariot race and set up a memorial in her honor as the only woman ever to win in the Olympics in antiquity. I should point out that as in horse racing now, the focus was not on the jockey or the charioteer, but rather on the owner of the chariot, which is how, for example, Alcibiades was able to finish first, second, and fourth in one Olympics. Hard to do if you're driving three different chariots, but not so hard if you're the owner of three different chariots. One of the greatest Spartans of all, in some ways to me the most appealing person in the historical record to have come from Sparta, was a guy by the name of Brasidas, who was killed in the 420s fighting for Lacedaemon. His mother, who has the name of Archelaonis, is another Spartan woman from whom we have a surviving statement, which I will read. Here's Archelaonis' statement about Brasidas. Some Amphipolitans came to Sparta and visited Archelaonis, the mother of Brasidas, after her son's death in victorious battle. She asked if her son had died nobly, in a manner worthy of Sparta, as they heaped praise on him and declared that in his exploits he was the best of all the Spartans, she said, and the Spartans just ate this up. Strangers, my son was indeed noble and brave, but Sparta has many better than he, the idea being that everybody who'd gone through the Agoge was potentially heroic. Later on, even more, after Sparta had been badly defeated, and in later centuries, as they were trying to reconstitute Spartan customs with a view towards reconstituting Spartan power, which involved in this instance the richest Spartans giving up all their money to the state so that it could be re-divided into kleroi, into land allotments, for a large number of Spartans to be. The leading figures in that movement were, on one level, Kings Agis IV and Cleomenes III, but even more prominently, Agis's grandmother and mother, Archidamia and Agisistrata, who were the richest people in Sparta and headlined the voluntary giving up of their property, his wife, Agiatis, and then the mother of Cleomenes, Crates Clea. So, Spartan women compiled a record unlike and considerably more distinguished than women anywhere else in Greece, and looked good doing it.
This ends Lecture 5.